Welcome to the Positively Midlife podcast. We are college friends, now in our 50s, exploring midlife together. Join us on this journey filled with honest discussion on the topics and challenges that are important to women at midlife.
Welcome back to the Midsters podcast. I am Tish with my co-host, Ellen, and special guest, Colette Durst. Today, we're going to be talking about the crisis of domestic violence. When our guest had posted an article in LinkedIn about her personal story of domestic abuse, she had no idea what the reaction would be. When you make yourself so vulnerable, you never know how people are going to react. But Colette moved bravely forward, and what she found out may surprise you.
That's right. And many of us may not know, but 1 in 3 women and 1 in 3 men in the U.S. will experience some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. Colette is going to share her own personal story from victim to vice president of a Fortune 500 company. And we are going to dispel the myth that strong women cannot be victims of domestic abuse. But before we get to Colette's story and how her peers reacted to that LinkedIn article, let's talk about our obsessions. Tish, what do you got for me this week?
So my obsession this week is white cowboy boots. So one of the big fashion trends coming up in the fall are cowboy boots. And I just had to do it. I had to pull the trigger and get these white cowboy boots. And I wore them with this rust colored dress. And it was kind of tattered at the ends and stuff like that. And I went to a thing with a bunch of friends to hear a really good friend's band. And they were playing. And I got so many compliments on these white boots.
Wow.
These are fabulous. And you know what? They're reasonable. And I'm going to tell you, go out and purchase something fun and fabulous this fall, like some white cowboy boots.
Now, did you wear these on your recent trip to the Big D down in Texas?
I did not. I didn't have them before Dallas. I got them after Dallas. And I wish I had them in Dallas because, they embrace the cowboy hat and the cowboy boots down there. It's all a thing. But it is really a trend right now, and it's an inexpensive. So we're going to post a very inexpensive pair of boots. So it's not a huge, huge investment you have to make. And let me tell you, it's just fun. And I had such a good reaction to wearing them. So I encourage you all.
Sounds fun.
Well, what about you, Ellen? What is your obsession this week?
Well, my obsession is in a totally different direction, but I just was on a long haul flight and one of my kids recommended a show called Hacks. I'm not sure. Have you heard of this show?
No, I haven't heard of this one.
I hadn't heard of it, but Jean Smart, back from the Designing Women in our days, the actress, she stars in it and she's won a couple Emmys. And let me tell you, I binged this show. I mean, for hours on this plane ride. And it is amazing. It's an HBO Max show. And it's about a young comedian writer who's blown up her career. She has to go work for this older woman, our age, Deborah Vance, a legendary Las Vegas stand-up comedy diva. It kind of made me think of Joan Rivers a little bit. And it's really about their relationship. It is laugh out loud comedy. It's drama. It's just amazing. I can't recommend it enough. So Hacks, everybody, HBO Max.
Love it. Love it. I got to check that one out.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Colette, we are so honored to have you here to share your story. And just to let you all know, Colette is another one of our amazing Trinity College tribe that we always talk about. And I'm just excited to hear. And again, it's a difficult topic, okay? Mm-hmm. Domestic abuse. And we've talked extensively, Colette, about, you know, I think people's perception of what the face of domestic abuse looks like. And we're here kind of to dispel that myth and to hopefully encourage women to step forward and seek help because strong, successful women can be suffering from domestic abuse. And Colette took a very brave step in exposing herself on this LinkedIn article, and we're going to get into that too. But thank you. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for taking that brave step, and you didn't know what was going to happen. And but before we kind of get started into that, I want our listeners to hear a little background. So after college, kind of what was your story? What was your journey?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you both for inviting me today. So I always wanted to become an attorney, but I came from a low-income family. My mother is a widow working for the church, and she had four kids to raise. So I never thought I could be an attorney. And quite honestly, I also had people telling me I'm too nice to be an attorney. I'm too empathetic. So I decided to become a paralegal after undergrad. And I started as a paralegal in a district attorney's office. And then when my then husband got stationed in Quantico, I got a job with a paralegal placement company. It was a temp to perm job in an intellectual property law firm. I started to do trademark work and I loved it. It was really interesting. I then looked at law school again and found out you could go at night. And I did that. And it took me 4.5 years because I didn't do summers, long, brutal, but I'm glad I did it. And I worked full time as a paralegal during the day. I was working during a paralegal during the day.
Do you feel sometimes society especially tells women and minorities really the things that they can't do, that they always talk about what obstacles and stuff? And I think what I love about your story is that despite you hearing about all these obstacles, that you still held on to that dream and you went forward to start that career.
Yeah, that's correct. I think you're right. I think especially as a woman, you're not, you know, it is just different expectations. And I was told different things. In addition to that, I was told by somebody in the military that that's not your job. And it's your husband that's an attorney. You don't need to be an attorney. You should be staying home. And it is a lot of things I was told that made me feel even more like I wanted to go to law school and prove them wrong.
Right. So many more challenges being put in front of you. You know, after law school, you went on to start a family, and I think many people probably thought you were living the American dream. And looking back on that time, what was kind of the first red flag or the first concern you had, Colette, about domestic issues?
Yeah, no, it's interesting because my ex-husband had been a good husband. I mean, I remember when the boys were newborns, he would stay up during the night and he would help me feed them. He would take time off of work all the time to take care of them, pick them up from school, make dinner. But when I first saw a change in him was after 9/11. He became obsessed with getting activated, which he did, which meant a pay cut for us, which was hard. I started a new firm. And at that time we had a 1.5-year-old and a 4-year-old. And then he became obsessed with going to Afghanistan. And when I would tell him I was having a tough time managing a home, a rental property, a new job, and little kids with him gone, he told me one time, tell that to the widows of those who died on 9/11. And he didn't care about my concerns. And that was that's the first time I realized he was changing. Mm-hmm.
That must have been very difficult.
It was really, really hard. And he was gone all the time. And then I found out he was actually really trying to deploy to Afghanistan without telling me. And it was just one Sunday he was leaving to go back to Camp Lejeune. And he said, I may be going to Kabul this week. As if he's going to go to Richmond. We're living in Alexandria. Yeah. I'm like, what? Now, Kabul, isn't that Afghanistan? Yeah, it was just hard. He didn't deploy, but you know, it was just, and they blamed me for not deploying. And it's just all these things that were just very, very difficult at the time.
You know, it was such a stressful time in our nation. And, you know, we were all trying to figure out like, what could we do to make America safer? And, you know, people were rallying around this. And I think anyone, especially in the military, probably felt that extra burden, that extra pressure to protect our nation under attack. And I'm sure there was very little assistance to those military people to guide them on this dual responsibility, you know, between their job and the nation and their families, and especially ones that had young families. So as your career was taking off and your personal life was starting to become a little bit more unstable, did you feel pressure to hide this increasing instability and this abusive behavior that was starting to escalate?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I felt pressure to hide, first of all, just out of shock. You know, I still remember the good guy, and here's this guy that was becoming really a monster. Personally, that's how I viewed it. And then shame. And I know my mom noticed the increase in drinking. My friends mm-hmm. saw how he was drinking more, but I never told people about the how abusive he was becoming. Now, people saw it one time, you know, and his main spiral was in 2005, starting in January. And one time during that time, he got so mad at one of our sons, he put our son underneath the tree during a lightning storm, major lightning storm, for a timeout. And my son was just crying. And I was hoping people had seen that so they could help me mm-hmm. because I was afraid. I didn't know what to do, but right. I didn't tell people.
He was what, 5 years old at the time, your son?
I had a 5 and 7 year old at that mm-hmm. time. Yeah.
Does he remember that, Colette?
Yeah. Yeah. He remember. Well, he gave testimony to the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps had them draw pictures and they videotaped them. And mm-hmm. so we had to do that because I was trying to get help from the Marine Corps. So I think he definitely remembers it.
Do you think because the military was so focused on responding to 9/11 that it may have overshadowed other things like responding to those threats to you that you were going through? Do you think it kind of just fell through the cracks because there were quote unquote bigger issues, or do you think it was because he was a reservist that he lacked some of the more in-depth support?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. You know, I think a lot of ways it's kind of, I think you used the term once, perfect storm. Because first of all, you know, we were at war, two wars at one time. Mm-hmm. We had not an understanding. The reservists took the brunt of the wars. So not really an understanding of how tough it is when you're a family and you know, he was working for the federal government. He was home by 5 every night. And I had a job in a law firm. And all of a sudden, one person's gone. And by the way, your salary's cut too. So it's not like you can bring in somebody to support you. And neighbors didn't understand it because, you know, nobody really, it's not like a base where people mm-hmm. were really there to help you. I remember telling somebody one day, not too long ago, that I just wanted somebody to bring in my garbage can during that time. Right. And, you know, I had great neighbors, but it was just like, nobody really understood mm-hmm. sometimes how hard it was. So I think that's it. You know, you couldn't get help. Because he's a reservist, I couldn't figure out where he belonged to get the help. Mm-hmm. I called headquarters. I called Quantico. I called Lejeune. Nobody knew where he fit. And then they finally said, well, talk to his commanding officer's wife, mm-hmm. who should be able to help you. And doing that, his commanding officer found out I was reaching out for help. And that created a lot of problems.
Wow. I bet it did.
Yeah.
You know, the Mayo Clinic studied what can lead to abuse. And we've been talking about a lot of these things in regards to the military, but they found that some factors that could increase a person's risk include a history of being abused or neglected themselves as a child, physical or mental illness, such as depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, family crisis, you know, all sorts of marital conflicts and parenting. Were any of these other things there for you guys as a couple, Colette?
Well, I really think PTSD played a role in what happened. I mean, he never wanted to say he had PTSD, and, you know, he never was formally diagnosed with PTSD. But from what I can tell, you know, between the heavy drinking, the quick to anger, the taking risks that he'd taken, all that added up to what appears to be PTSD. I mean, at one point, he started drinking several Manhattans a night. if you know what's in a Manhattan, it's all alcohol mm-hmm. and top of wine or beer. He would start drinking in the morning. Even his mother called me one time and said he came to visit and she was surprised he'd have a couple of Coors Lights first thing in the morning. So he definitely was somebody who didn't do that. Oh, he even told me he was drinking at work. He kept a stash, he told me, in his office.
Wow. Do you see that drinking maybe was a sign that he was attempting to self-medicate because he was feeling out of control?
Yeah, I think so. I think he, the PTSD, you know, PTSD is very complicated, but one thing I think triggered the PTSD, one was, you know, having been to Iraq. So he eventually went to Iraq in 2003. But then when he was in Iraq, he had an affair and he broke it off when I found out about it. And then his lover in Iraq took a military issued phone and fired 4 shots into the phone using a military issued weapon, one for each of us. So one for my youngest son, oldest son, one for my ex-husband and one for me. And wow. CID investigated and he was moved from his current job, the job he had, back to his former job. And he said it was the most humiliating day in his life. So I think the combination of things, again, going back to the theme of the perfect storm, mm-hmm. I think it all came together and he just was self-medicating. He couldn't handle it.
So I see this kind of reoccurring theme of you kept reaching out to the people in the chain of command, but you were not receiving the help for you, for your family, or even for him.
Correct.
Also, Colette, I know that you were keeping it all together for your kids on the home front and really trying to obviously make everything seem okay for them. What a double duty you were having to do, trying to get help for your husband, your ex-husband now, and really keeping your kids safe and protected. And I just, my heart is just really going out to you hearing this.
Yeah, no, it was really hard. And I was having a lot of stomach issues from the stress and yeah, it was really hard. And he then became so fixated at one point on going back to Iraq to save the troops, kept thinking he had to save the troops. So some irrational ways of thinking started happening. Mm-hmm. And he said he wouldn't go back to Iraq. And then he's trying to get back to Iraq without me knowing it again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really a really tough time. And then the heavy drinking and heavy spending, going back to PTSD, spending a lot, and then so quick to anger all the time. It was really hard.
And then you're keeping this all hidden.
I'm keeping it all hidden.
The burden was on you.
Yeah.
And you were doing it silently without that support. Mm-hmm. So now there's multiple studies that have shown that domestic violence rates are higher amongst military members than the civilian population. And this idea of cultural spillover theory has been given as one of the possible reasons for mm-hmm. these higher rates of violence.
Hey, Tish, can you just share with us what is cultural spillover theory, especially for our listeners if they're not aware of it?
Sure. So cultural spillover theory holds that the more society tends to legitimize the use of violence to attain its ends, and for which there is widespread social approval for that, the greater the likelihood of illegitimate violence. So this is especially why the military needs to take these reports from spouses seriously and when they reach out for help, because just the reaching out for help is that comes after not the first time, that comes after, you know, a lot of desperation. And so instead of ignoring them and sweeping it under the rug, Colette, do you feel that your husband's escalations had to do some with maybe this cultural spillover theory and the PTSD?
Yeah, definitely. And I think about it, you know, when you have a reservist that goes over to Iraq or Afghanistan or, you know, another place of conflict, when they come back, they're normally checked for PTSD as part of the process. Well, he was in a different group. He came back on a commercial airline with General Garner and some other people and arrived in Dulles. There was nobody checking on him. So he went from one moment from a very violent world of conflict and war. And he said there was one time there's a bomb in the ground and they had to dodge it. And this like really heightened sense of your adrenaline's always flowing. And one minute he's back in rural Virginia where it's all green and he's having to make dinner for kids. And it's to not be checked out for PTSD is wrong. Mm-hmm. And he's
not given any help to cope with any of this.
Not
given any help mm-hmm. to cope with it.
And what really is the worst thing I think about this is that, you know, they had to have known about the heavy drinking, and that is one obvious symptom of PTSD, mm-hmm. and didn't do anything about it. But what they did definitely know about is, you know, one day he just lost it and he dropped off our sons at a neighbor's house. They were 5 and 7 and said, I'm going to go to Home Depot. Told her I'm going to Home Depot. I was at work. He sent me a text. I don't think he even called it. You know, I can't remember anymore, saying he dropped the kids off at Katie's house. And I told her I'm going to Home Depot, but I'm not coming back. Wow. And they knew he abandoned his family. He was a lieutenant colonel at that time. And that should have been something, right? Between the affair, the heavy drinking, the other stuff I reported to the Marine Corps, that should have been enough. But no, they didn't do anything.
And Colette, you know, I'm curious. Many, many times we hear that an abusive partner really tries to isolate the person, like from friends, from family. Did you experience this happening? And, you know, were these sudden or gradual changes? And I know just not being able to be truthful and trying to hold it together, in a sense, is some isolation, right?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. But definitely, I think one of the things he did was he kept me so busy. So here's a guy that used to, if one of our kids was sick, he would stay home, take the day off. Because in the military, as a reservist, he had 30 days off or more. I had no time off because I had billable hours and a tough job. But he always took that time off. And all of a sudden, he had no time for the kids. He all of a sudden couldn't make dinner, couldn't take the kids anywhere. It was all on me. Everything was on me. So in addition to working a demanding job, I had to pick up the kids from school, take the kids to school. So I was isolated, but not in the ways that we think about traditionally. I just had no time for anything else.
Right.
Except keep the family together.
Yeah. He wasn't like cutting you off from your girlfriends or your sister or your mom. It was more isolation by you just being work to the bone across the board.
Exactly. Exactly.
So many times they say it takes an average woman 7 times before they are able to successfully leave an abusive partner. And I know he kind of figured that out for you by leaving. And I'm kind of glad he did. I think he did a favor in the end. But what strengths do you feel that you had really had to draw on from within yourself to handle the whole leaving, to handle all of a sudden now it is on you, everything's on you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, going back to, you know, leaving, I did think about leaving before several times, especially there was a time where he threw me against the bed in anger when I asked him about his heavy spending. Because he went through almost all, we sold a rental property. I forgot how much we made, at least $150,000. He went through all that quickly. He was buying crazy stuff, like $10,000 worth of Harley gear, bought a Harley Davidson. So I was thinking of leaving several times and I just was scared. It's a scary thing. There's one time when my aunt was ill in Ireland and I went to Ireland for a long weekend to take care of her. And I asked him to, you know, here's a number for the dog sitter. Make sure the dog sitter lets, you know, our dog out, big 80-pound German Shepherd, letting her out during the middle of the day. If you're not going to take the days off, 2 days, all I asked him to watch the kids. And he left that poor dog in a cage from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. And of course, she had diarrhea all over the cage. And at that time, when I came home, I was like, I can't, how could I be with this guy who won't even, doesn't even take time to take care of our beloved dog?
And you said, like, previously he'd been a dog lover. So it wasn't somebody who was insensitive to animals, but this was just really speaking to where his mental state was at that time.
Oh, exactly. I think it's a good reflection of his mental state because he's always kind to dogs and he would always just take the day off. Like when I was traveling, he had 30 days of vacation. He would just take the 2 days off or take half days. No time. And that per dog. And the next day he left the dog in our master bedroom. Shiva was her name and beautiful shepherd. And she then pooped all over the master bedroom. And then he tells me while I'm in Ireland, checking in on my sick aunt. And it's my fault somehow that she had pooped everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that was another time to leave. But you're right. Once it was a relief that he left, I have to say, but it was hard. It was hard because I was like, I got to get away from him and I got to protect my kids. And what do? I need a security system. I need a lawyer. He left the house under construction that he was managing, a big hole in the backyard for walk-up basement. If it wasn't for my mom, she stepped in to try to get these contractors to do the work. It was a miserable, miserable time.
So besides the drinking, and there were other symptoms for the escalated violence. So what I'm hearing from you, so there was adultery, excessive drinking, violence, reckless financial decisions. And when we had talked to you had said that you were questioned about several weapons that he had purchased that you were unaware of at the time. So
yeah, that was really scary. Yeah.
So during this, were you seeing this rapid escalation or were you just trying to like just keep things together? And now that you look back on it or were you just kind of just too busy dealing with that day to day?
I saw the rapid escalation. Well, I knew something was wrong with the weapons, but I was trying to manage it all. But I was trying, and now I've learned more. After that, I started learning more about domestic abuse, studying it and realizing, you know, what I went through and you know, what it is. But the guns were especially disconcerting because when he walked out on us, we were left with very little money because he had depleted our savings, as I mentioned. And he was saying he was going to live like a monk. And I go to the Marine Corps base I have to register my car, renew my tags. And they go, ma'am, do you still have those weapons? And I go, I don't have any weapons. They go, well, looks here, like 2 months ago, you registered or your husband registered two shotguns, a rifle and a 9mm. I was like, well, why does he need those? So I went to my attorney and of course they're like, well, you know, he's a Marine. He's able to have guns. Why are you so worried? I think, and his attorney probably told my attorney, I think she's paranoid. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, they were always criticizing me and I was considered being overly worried, but who buys, like he was like, my former neighbor was a doctor, a medical doctor even said he was showing signs of instability. Why would he go out and buy like four weapons, not just one, four?
And not tell you. So you were not unaware of it until the base notified you that there were actually these weapons and you had young children in the house. So that was something that you definitely should have known.
Right. Yeah. And that would make me think, what else do I not know? And heighten how worried I would be. So I completely agree with how you were feeling at that point, Colette. It's so valid hearing those things and being surprised.
Yeah.
So you guys ended up getting a divorce. And did that go easy or did that go hard?
Oh my God. No, it was so hard. I know. Okay. And I found out later, there's a lot of good studies on this. And actually, you know, there's so much information on this. I wish I had known at the time. It probably, I would say totally probably took 9 years, not the actual official divorce, but between the last legal action he filed against me was 2014. So think about it, I filed for divorce in 2005. During that time, he used the court system. You know, I sold the marital house to a friend and did so without using a real estate agent, just to, you know, try to get some money, right? Because I needed money to buy another house. And he was in Iraq, back in Iraq. And his response was, "I'm so happy you sold the house to, you know, so X and Y. But I'm going to ask that all the proceeds go into escrow until I get back from Iraq," which he knew I had a contract on a house to buy in Arkansas, and I couldn't buy that house without the money because I had no money.
Let me make this clear. You weren't taking all the money for just you. It was your part of the money that he wanted
my part
also
of the money.
Held up, right?
Yeah, all it was my part. It was going to be split directly in half, even though I had to do all the work to get the house sold. I had to do everything. And we're talking like begging contractors to finish this work that he just couldn't do. It was just my half of the proceeds, which is very little money, really. And no, he wanted, so my sister reached out to his mom, reached out to my then husband and begged him. And he reluctantly agreed to release my half of the money, my half of my money. So yeah, it's funny. But I think the worst, though, to be honest, you know, with you all, the worst of it was I did luckily bought the house in Arkansas, beautiful house, you know, got the boys stable, went and got them into a nice, you know, really good school. It was a wonderful Catholic school. And they, you know, they'd been through a lot of trauma, obviously. And we were set up, we had our German Shepherd, Shiva came with us. That's another story, having to get her to Arkansas. But so he comes back from Iraq and his attorney calls my attorney and says, and by this time we're in Arkansas, right? I've been sued in three different states. But guess what? My attorney calls my aunt, Ann, who's a nun lawyer, who's helping me at this time because it was so bad. He goes, "Well, guess what? Colette's husband told my aunt, said she bought the house in Arkansas while she was married, so he's going to force the sale of it." Ugh. And which means we'd have no place to live. And luckily, we were able to prove the only equity in the house in Arkansas was from the proceeds from the sale of the marital home. But just think about that. Well, who does that? You know, the kids would be moved again. And it's not easy to find a house that takes an 80-pound German Shepherd if you were to rent, you know?
Yeah. Right. And just why wouldn't he want stability for his children? I think that's the part that, you know, somebody who's mentally stable and mentally sound, you would think would want their children to be in a stable environment.
Exactly. Not have them move again and be disrupted yet again.
So kind of, I'm really curious, and I'm sure our listeners are too. What prompted you to want to write about any of this in LinkedIn? So, and again, it wasn't like a article about abuse, but it was the words you used were bringing the war home. And that was a signal to many other women of what you really meant was this domestic issue at home. And you had a lot of women reach out to you from that article, didn't you?
I did. And I don't know what inspired me with the article. I think it was because, you know, after being sued for 9 years and he tried to do his best so I couldn't, you know, I'm not allowed to share any documents, things like that. He, you know, there's things he kept suing me. And, but I just felt like it was time to tell a bit of my story. And partly because I think, you know, my mom has been deceased now since 2013, my brother since 2014, and they're always so proud of me. And I just said, you know what, it's time for me to try to pay back and let people know that even if you hit obstacles in your life, be it you're born, you know, you don't have a wealthy family, or you face abuse, or you face times when you don't have any money, you can overcome those challenges. It won't be easy. But the symbol I like to use is, and I think I put that in the article, is that it's like the phoenix, right? You may crash and burn, but you'll come out of the ashes more beautiful than you were. And I truly believe that. I truly believe that.
And it's just getting up, right? That one simple step that can lead to so many other really great things happening.
Definitely. It's getting up and getting support, right? Like, that's why this Midsters is such a great podcast. Getting support of other women. There's power. I had one mediator tell me that I better settle the case because the judge will love my ex-husband. This is here in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, your ex-husband's a Marine Corps hero and a lawyer. And I go, what am I, just a woman? And he didn't answer. Ooh. Yeah. He just shrugged his shoulders. But I think so much of it is we are more powerful than we think we are, because we spent so much time either being told we're not as strong as we are, or just society not giving women credit for what we have achieved and what it takes to achieve what we achieve, that it's time to pay it forward and give people hope. Give people hope.
Absolutely. I think that article gave you back your power.
Yeah.
I think it probably empowered a lot of other women. To me, it changes that visual of who is a domestic abuse person. It's not the woman cowering without a job. I mean, yes, it can be, but it can also be that corporate executive as well. And the silence is what holds the healing back, I think. And I think you bravely sharing that story, I just hope it reaches some ears of somebody that is at that point that says, I've had enough. And I am strong enough. And I've tried to hold things together for my family or my kids. But I'm getting out. And they develop a plan to do that. And but I think that's what it's all about, is in what you were saying. We are so powerful when we come together as women, when
that's
we support each other. We are incredibly powerful.
And I think that vulnerability, Colette, that you talked about too, when we're vulnerable, other people can come and help us and can come and support us. And I've always kind of been like, I'll put my best foot forward, which could mean not saying anything, right? And when you do let other people in and you show that vulnerability, I've just been surprised here at midlife by doing that. The richness that has come to me, the riches, right, from other women's support.
You know, that's right. Well said. And I agree with you. And I think we all need to do that, right? Because I think so often we are afraid to show our vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And we need to show it because, you know, my mother used to always say, ask for help. There are people will give it. And I sometimes, this is later in life, but I need to remember that advice, or I like the way you put it, you know, it's okay to be vulnerable and you'll get people to help you.
And I think, especially for those strong women, I think in a work environment, we feel we have to be iron and we can't show any vulnerability or any weakness, or it's perceived a certain kind of way. And we need to do away with that mentality. We as women need to support each other, come together and say, it's okay. It's okay to talk about these things. It's okay to get that support to move forward. You know, I think as women, we forget to do some self-care.
Yes, I agree with you, Tish. Let's talk about that a little bit. You know, self-care to really help recover from the effects of emotional abuse. You know, in fact, many physical and sexual abuse survivors had said that it was really the emotional abuse that was the most devastating to them and had the longest term effects. It really cuts to the core, you know, really attacking your well-being. And abuse victims also can suffer from PTSD, depression, and anxiety. Colette, what did you do around any of these things, around practicing self-care?
Yeah, great question. Because for a long time, I just things were so crazy. I just didn't, you know, I always made sure to try to run, you know, walk the dogs every day, center myself when I walk the dogs. But it just was
tennis.
A constant tennis.
Tennis? Yeah.
tennis was key. Yes, Tish, I know you're a tennis player now, but or pickleball, tennis. Yeah. And even to this day, I mean, tennis is how, you know, there are days I play, you know, doubleheaders, tennis, even this heat of Florida, but that is so wonderful. But I'm getting better at other types of self-care. You know, nowadays I try to have my breakfast while watching the sunrise and do more meditation, but I wasn't good at it back then because I was either starting a new job or racing kids around. And thank goodness I had my mom to help me and my sister and my brother, Brian. But when I didn't have them, it was really, really hard to find any extra time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are days I was working. I did the math one day. I'm like, okay, I'm working 10 hours a day minimum. I'm driving 3. I like to sleep at least 8. So that gives me 21. That gives me like 3 hours to make dinner and take a shower.
And do homework.
And do homework.
Do homework with the kids. Walk the dogs. Right. Yeah. A load of laundry here
and
there.
Load of laundry here and there. I mean, a lot of times you almost like feel like you're, you know, taking conference calls while chopping vegetables. It wasn't as bad as that, but I feel like, you know, things can be pretty darn crazy. So it's more about slowing things down, taking that time for self-care. And but it's
and
hard.
I think it's a testament to you that going through this, you raised 2 amazing sons who are very successful, very independent, successful boys.
And have excelled in your career.
Excelled in your career. You have found that time to follow your special interests like running and tennis and things like that. So I know you are an avid writer for LinkedIn and doing articles and kind of teaching and sharing. So I don't know. You really maximized those 3 hours, didn't you?
Well, back then, I don't think that was an exception time. It was right after my mom died and I had nobody to pick up the kids from school. Back then I didn't do as much. I don't think I was even playing any tennis back then. I'm better about that. And tennis is good because you commit to people, right? So you can't, it's not like, you know, when things are going hard, you're like, oh, I can go for a run or I could just sit on the couch and veg. Tennis, like, oh my God, I told 3 other people I'll be on the court. I have to be there. So it's great.
Now, Colette, what is one piece of advice that you would give a woman who finds herself in a similar situation of domestic abuse? What would you give her? What piece of message would you give her to give her the courage to take that first step?
Yeah, gosh, there's so many things I've like to tell somebody, but I think, so you're talking about one piece of advice to take the first step. So we're not talking about a plan. It's just to take the first step. I would say the biggest advice would be, really contact your local, domestic abuse support group. Cause here in South Florida, I've done work with AVDA, Aid to Victims of Domestic Abuse, and they have experts. They have people on their phone lines. They actually have a shelter where they take dogs. You know, a lot of women don't leave abusers. And I think about that with what my ex did, then husband did to my German Shepherd. Like, would you leave a dog with somebody like that? Like, So I think that's really my piece of advice because that one spot can give them all the advice they need. They can hook them up with a good lawyer that knows about domestic abuse. I can't tell you about how many lawyers had no clue. Especially emotional abuse. Oh my gosh, there's no scars. It doesn't matter that you have these deep, you know, hidden scars. They wanted to see real scars. They'll hook you up with people who have expertise in finances to help you find a way to have enough money to escape. They'll give you a place to stay. I mean, that would be my one piece of advice. There's so many great groups out there all over the country.
And, you know, Colette, we will put links in our show notes to all of the organizations you mentioned, as well as the National Domestic Violence Hotline as well. So if anyone knows someone who's going through this kind of situation or is going through it themselves, they'll have some resources in our show notes. I can't thank you enough for sharing your story with us. And I know that this is really going to help a lot of people.
Well, I hope so, because I hope I made a lot of mistakes, you know, it was hard. And, but in the end, you know, thankfully, you know, like you all said, things worked out, but quite often it could have gone the other way. And I want to help people as much as I can, and maybe more, you know, as, you know, we all think about what we want to do in retirement. I'd love to help women even more once that time comes. So
that's amazing. Fabulous.
Colette, thank you so much
for
taking those brave steps and doing that article and being here with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Till next time, Midsters. That's
until next week.
The Positively Midlife podcast will drop every Wednesday. Become part of our tribe of women excited to thrive in midlife. Like, subscribe, and follow us wherever you listen, and invite your friends along. Until next time, have a great week.